Our next case is A21-0328, Plotzinski versus Budzinski. I hope I'm pronouncing those names right. I'm sure that the attorneys will correct me if I'm wrong. You each will have 15 minutes with 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant if you decide to use it. This hearing is being recorded, and as if we were actually at the Minnesota Judicial Center, no recording by other people is allowed. The recording will be posted on our website within 24 hours. When you begin your argument, please state your name for the record. And with that, is the attorney for the appellant ready to begin?
I am, Your Honor.
You may start.
Great. Thank you, Your Honor. Counsel, may it please the court. My name is Dominique Navarre. I represent the appellant, Mark Plotzinski, who is present via Zoom here. Your Honor, this is a post-dissolution matter that was venued in Olmsted County, where the respondent motioned the court to enforce my client's spousal maintenance obligation, and in relevant part, moved the court to for attorney's fees, bad faith attorney's fees. My client cross-motioned to modify or terminate his spousal maintenance obligation based on substantial change in circumstances. The court granted respondents to motions in relevant part somewhat granted my client's motion to modify his spousal maintenance obligation, decreased it from $3,666 a month to $2,000 based on a substantial change in circumstances. The standard of review here is abuse of discretion. My client believes that the district court, in fact, abused her discretion by not terminating his maintenance obligation and focusing more on the allegation that he dissipated some non-marital inheritance that he received post-dissolution. And I think, Your Honors, that what's really important here, and I think what the district court shied away from a bit didn't consider his income in whole, because maintenance, by definition, according to Minnesota Statute 518.03, is defined as an award made in a dissolution or legal separation proceeding of payments from the future income or earnings of one spouse for the support and maintenance of another. So the district court, while they did focus on his income, I think focused a bit more on this allegation that he dissipated some non-marital assets.
I ask you, with respect to that, you would agree that with respect to a motion modify, if one intentionally voluntarily reduces one's income for the purpose of avoiding maintenance, that can be taken into account in determining a modification.
Absolutely, Your Honor. That's correct. In fact, I believe the case law is clear about that, where an obligor voluntarily creates a change in circumstances, in other words, decreases income voluntarily,
right,
the court should consider those motives.
So let's focus then. I'm wondering, I think respondent argues that you did not challenge the factual findings of the court, and I wanted to ask you if that's correct. In your view, are you challenging the factual findings of the district court?
Well, I think from the standpoint that the court addresses his income, not necessarily. I think the court identified the fact that his income is now $2,699 a month. And in fact, the court identified that he can't make his obligations or even his budgetary needs based on that income.
Let me ask you more specifically then. The district court found, in finding of fact 65, that the petitioner deliberately and in bad faith gave away sizable income producing assets that result in his marital settlement agreement with his second wife that resulted in a decrease in his income. I understand what you're saying about his employment income, but I'm asking whether you are challenging the factual finding that he gave away in bad faith income producing assets.
Yes. Yeah. I'm glad you specified that, Your Honor. In fact, yes, we are, because my client detailed that in his declaration, and certainly his responsive declaration, I believe that he did not give away income producing assets. And Your Honor, I recall during the hearing, Judge Hayne asked me about this, the notion that he got rid of or this marital home, or not marital homestead, but this homestead that was valued at $320,000. And she asked me if that was an income producing property or that could be an income producing property. And I was kind of taken back a little bit, not taken back, I guess, kind of surprised that she asked me the question, because there was no evidence that house was in fact income producing. In fact, the court explained in its findings that it was non-marital, it was inherited. Even the respondent herself admitted in her declaration that it was inherited. So,
but I don't know that I'm not sure that the marital or non-marital, I'm not focused on that because this is obviously post-dissolution, yeah. And the motion to modify depends on what one's incomes and earnings are and whether there's a substantial change that would render the maintenance obligation unfair. Obviously the earnings are non-marital when you continue to earn money after your dissolution. So my question is, where in your appellate brief to us did you challenge a factual finding that he gave away, factual finding 65?
Yeah, I don't
your,
know that.
Your argument to us in your brief to us.
Sure, understood, Your Honor. Yeah, I don't know that I specifically argued that factual finding, Your Honor, but I guess I think we sort of suggested it in there that we focused on his income. And I guess what I was getting at was when Judge Hayne asked me that question, you'll see it in the transcript. I didn't really have an answer for that because, I mean, technically a house can be income producing, a car can be income producing, but there was no evidence that that was in fact income producing. So I guess to answer your question, Your Honor, we didn't argue that in the appellate brief, but I think we sort of suggested it because, you know, we argue that his income, that the court didn't focus on his income. By awarding $2,000 a month, because I think if the court did that, then the court would not have simply modified the award to $2,000 a month, but it would have decreased or either terminated or decreased it significantly. Because again, the court indicated that he can't make his budgetary needs on $2,699 a month. I mean, so
Mr. Navarro, a follow-up to Judge Smith's question is finding of fact 66, the one that follows, that says petitioner intentionally withheld discovery documents from respondent to hide his dissipation of income producing assets. And so in the beginning of your brief and statement of case, your last sentence is, appellant's current income, which is undisputed. When I read the order, I think it is disputed. I don't think the judge is able to know because documents weren't produced, what exactly your client's income is. Am I wrong in my reading of that with regard to the order?
I don't know if you're wrong or if you're correct there, Your Honor, but I mean, if the court wasn't aware of what his income was, I think the court could have noted that, but the court didn't do that. They said that his income is in fact.
Well, I think it's implicit in saying because he withheld discovery documents of income producing assets. So I think it certainly is implicit in what the judge wrote.
Okay. And Your Honor, it very well may be. My client will certainly dispute that he hid dissipation or didn't respond to the discovery and certainly hid his dissipation of income producing assets. But here again, if the court identified this house, for example, again, but didn't specify that that's income producing or I mean, there is no none of the documents or submissions to the court identified that it was in fact income producing.
Navarro, if our review is abuse of discretion and the court recognized that your client had forced retirement and now is relying on Social Security, it did reduce the maintenance. But I think to Judge Smith's and Judge Riley's point, the reason it didn't reduce it to zero and terminate it was because there seemed to be issues both with intentional dissipation of assets and or, assets that are out there, well, that may or may not be out there, that the court is concerned, are out there. And therefore, and that's why it didn't terminate. So I guess, whether you agree with that or not, there is a certain logic to that decision. And since we review it for clear abuse of discretion, I'm hard pressed to see how that is a clear abuse of discretion. Perhaps you can enlighten me as to why I'm wrong.
Well, Your Honor, I think that, when it comes down to what the court ordered, this $2,000 a month, I think the court abused discretion from the standpoint that there's really just setting Mr. Pluchinski up for failure, right? He can't make this obligation. The court noted that in its findings of fact. And I guess perhaps the court could have or should have, estimated what Mr. Pluchinski's income is or might have been. And in fact, the court can do that for purposes of maintenance. I had some case law suggest that, but I don't recall what that case is, but the court can estimate what an obligor's income is for purposes of maintenance and modification.
I was going to ask you about a comment or a statement that you make on page 7 of your brief, where you say that there's no dispute that he involuntarily lost his job at IBM and that his only income is Social Security. I thought that he also received a portion of his pension.
Your Honor, at that time, he was not earning that. He did not get that pension. It was later on, I believe now Mr. Pluchinski might be earning that pension, but the court should not take in consideration. This is a pension that was awarded to him during the dissolution. And I believe the respondent is now earning half of that pension or a portion of that pension. But if the court takes that into consideration, goes against the Khrushchev case, where the court should not take in consideration income generated from a marital asset that was awarded to the individual during the marriage. And that's exactly what that IBM pension is or was.
I guess my view of a pension payment is that it's income that he receives each month that he can use to live on.
And here again, Judge Riley, that Mr. Pluchinski was not earning that pension at that time. Actually, to date, I don't know if he is. I suspect he might be. But at that time, and I believe Judge Hain was aware of that he was not earning that pension. I believe she noted that in the findings of fact. But nevertheless, from a definition standpoint, sure, a pension payment is income. But here again, Your Honor, I believe it's, again, the Khrushchev case that mentions or explains that the court should not consider earnings from an asset, i.e. a pension or some retirement account that's awarded to the individual during the dissolution, because that's double dipping, so to speak. I believe that's how the court reasoned. But at this point, Your Honor, Your Honors, we believe that the court abused its discretion against setting Mr. Pluchinski up for failure. He's earning $2,699 a month. I think some of the assets that the court, it appears to me that the court and Mr. Pluchinski, that the court sort of punished him, I guess, on the notion that he was or allegedly dissipating his assets, whether they're income producing or not income producing, and awarded $2,000 accordingly. So, and with respect to the court's order in favor of the respondent for attorney's fees, Mr. Pluchinski asked the court to review that as well, again, under abuse of discretion standard. He doesn't feel that he should have to pay her attorney's fees for the period in which the court ordered, because it was contemplated in the decree that he could move the court to modify. So he doesn't feel that the court should have ordered him to pay those fees because it was in fact contemplated in the decree. So
Mr. Navarro, relative to the attorney's fees, the court awarded 9,000 plus for a period of time between August 12th and December 8th. Did that represent respondents full attorney's fees over that time?
I think during that time, Your Honor, but I think there were some previous attorney's fees that it did not represent, but during that time, from what I understand, yes, it did.
Okay. So, and the August 12th date, does that correspond to the initiation of the respondent's motion to enforce the maintenance obligation?
Is that it does.
Okay. Not yes. The later motion by your client to modify that occurred later. Is that correct?
No. Well, actually, Your Honor, they were in conjunction with each other. So the respondent moved the court to enforce the the award, my client crossed motion to modify and terminate his.
On that same day?
Not the same day. It was a responsive motion, Your Honor.
Okay. So that's what I was wondering. When you say he has that's all I was wondering. It was sometime after that. Okay. I just wanted to know what that date correlated to. Thank
that's
you.
That's correct. Yes. Yeah, very good. All right. I understand, Your Honors, this is a very narrow issue. I don't have anything else for the court at this point, so I'll rest and defer to respondent.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Attorney for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kaynard Hunt, and I represent the respondent, Ellen Budinski. The trial court did not abuse its broad discretion in denying appellant's motion to terminate his spousal maintenance obligation to respondent and awarding respondent $9,676.55 in attorney's fees. Accordingly, a respondent requests affirmance. Here, the trial court was presented with a situation where appellant at age 63 began in July 2018 his campaign seeking to terminate his spousal maintenance obligation to respondent, which maintenance obligation he had agreed to by stipulation. Appellant in July 2018 initiated court proceedings for the goal of terminating maintenance, saying he was anticipating retirement. Respondent answered discovery fully. Appellant did not. And then in 2018, appellant discontinued court proceedings. Just 2 months later, appellant then deeded a $320,000 unencumbered home he inherited from his mother to his second wife. And then he was gifting extensively to his children to the extent of $52,000. Then we go to March.
But he says that was for their education. And $52,000 isn't that much to go towards two people's educations.
But he's doing it at a time when he's looking, he says, to retire. He has his obligation to my client. So to the fact that this is what he's doing, and at times it's not all to education, as I understand it, because there was $5,000 he just simply gifted because that's what he does.
So, counsel, if I can, let's assume, I mean, when I looked at it, I think you argued, let's focus on the dissipation of the income producing assets, because I think, unless you disagree with me, the question is what the assets that are allegedly dissipated, using that term loosely, considering the framework we're in, which is a motion to modify maintenance, they have to be income producing, right? It's not, that's critical that they're income producing in order to determine whether he voluntarily and in bad faith reduced his income. Right.
I disagree actually with that premise, because the Minnesota Supreme Court in the case of Sieber versus Sieber at 258 Northwest 2nd 754 footnote 2 looked at whether it was a asset that whether liquidated could diminish future earning capacity. And so the court looked at earning capacity of an asset, not just whether it at the time is earning income.
Oh, yes. Okay. So in the future, it could be, but it wouldn't be the principle of the asset. It has to, what we're looking at is whether you reduced your ability to earn money on that later asset, right?
Right.
And I think you argue, and I think those courts, District Court's factual finding 65, which I focused on before, I think you argue in your brief that there was no challenge to the factual finding. When I look at the appellant's brief, he does argue that the dissipation was erroneous because they were not non-marital assets. He also not income producing, and also says at one point in his brief on page 11, there's no evidence that the appellant dissipated his assets, let alone income producing assets. So let's pretend accept as a premise that that is a challenge to the factual finding. Can you tell us what are the income producing assets that were dissipated per 65? And what is the record support for that?
Certainly.
Finding?
Well, I mean, first of all, as the court is well aware, I mean, the standard is clearly erroneous, which viewing the facts most favorable to the trial court and the trial court's ability to judge credibility. And we also have the issue here overlaying that his failure to fully answer discovery. So all of that goes into that mix. So in that context, What we have is the house, which is what is a capital asset that he could have done a number of things. He could have sold it and invested the income. He could have rented it out and received income, or he could live in it and reduce his living expenses. So there's three different things that he could have done with that house. Then what we know from the record is he gave his second wife of just 3 years in a marital termination agreement 50% of his IBM pension starting the day after his divorce from respondent, which was in 2007, through May 2019, his date of divorce from his second wife. He also gave his second
And that was his share of the IBM pension?
It would be not because we're post-divorce to respondent. So it would be income that would be available to respondent to pay her spousal maintenance, but for the fact that he decided to go do this to stipulate to this to his second wife of 3 years. And then we also have that he gave to his second wife 100% of his IBM 401k through March 2019. We also know
that 401k, that was an asset that was entirely his after the divorce, or maybe it postdated the
as far as we know, yes. So it was it was non-marital as to my client.
Gotcha. Okay.
Okay. And then we have, after reaching that agreement, he continued to pay his second ex-wife's expenses outside the terms of the marital termination agreement. So he was paying utility bills for the home that he gave to his second wife. So, I mean, you got the trial court that's looking at all of this and saying that this is bad faith and that what you were doing was decreasing your income so you could come into the court and make these assertions. And what the trial court found here is not clearly erroneous.
So then I think, I wanted to get your take on it. I think I heard opposing counsel say that the district court should have estimated what the income should have been in order to determine what the amount would be. So there's some amount of income that's income that's dissipated by virtue of this, but the district court doesn't tell us how much that is in order to decide how much to decrease the maintenance obligation. And I'd like you to speak to that. Why that step doesn't seem to be explicit here? And so how do you make the financial determinations?
Right, because the court need not do that, because as the court said in the Eisenreich case at 668 Northwest 2nd at 243, a party on appeal can't complain about an unfavorable ruling when the party failed to provide evidence necessary to address the question in issue. So, I mean, it all goes back to the fact that he didn't respond to the discovery. He didn't present the evidence to the court. And as this court said in Tuthill, I believe it was, that a party can't complain when inadequate documentation leads to denial of the motion. And as the Supreme Court said in Solemn at 255 Northwest 2nd, it is quite simply unacceptable to provide non-responsive and inadequate documentation, and that justifies the adverse inferences by the district court. So I think here the district court, when you couple this with the fact that he just simply failed to provide the information. I mean, if you look at what we have here, he didn't provide the bank statements. He doesn't have a bank statement even showing his Social Security deposit. There were no bank documents provided showing that he was continuing to pay monthly rent. There was no lease document as to any lease agreement after December 31, 2020. We asked for information with regard to the inheritance from his brother and his mother He said he spent it all, but he couldn't identify where it went, and he refused to provide any of the documentation relating to inheritance from either his mother or brother's state. When we looked at the marital termination agreement with his second wife, it lists certain of appellant's bank accounts and appellant and his second wife's joint bank accounts. It doesn't list his second wife's separate bank accounts. And it further says there are other unlisted bank accounts owned by appellant alone. When we looked at the marital termination agreement, it states appellant has a Roth IRA with no mention of any traditional IRAs. When respondent pointed out that appellant's tax return shows deductible IRAs and Roth IRAs are not tax deductible, that accordingly there appeared to be additional IRA accounts out there that haven't been disclosed, appellant's response is that he had both and it was simply missed in the marital termination agreement. Appellant also made no disclosure whether received a severance package from IBM. So here we have this whole set of circumstances out there where appellant didn't present this. He hasn't identified nor presented argument that the trial court's findings are clearly erroneous applying the applicable law. So here the trial court in its discretion, given what it was given, certainly didn't abuse its discretion in refusing to terminate spousal maintenance under the facts of this case. And we ask that this court affirm.
May I, it sounds like you might be ready to switch to the attorney fees question. The district court, as I understand the order, gave three reasons, I think, for the award of attorney's fees. Stopping paying maintenance, letting the life insurance lapse, and then not responding to discovery. The first two reasons appear to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, that those appear not to be reasons that are within the litigation if it's measured from the date of August 12th, I guess, but instead appear to me the actions that prompted the litigation, in other words, outside the litigation. And the discovery seems to be action that perhaps made like more lengthy or difficult or whatever the litigation. So because we have case law saying that we do not, that statute doesn't provide for conduct-based fees for matters outside the litigation, and I didn't see case law in your brief that supported those reasons, although there's lots of case law you cited on the discovery. I wanted you to speak to that. Like why is the attorney's fees not an abuse of discretion if it relies on matters outside the litigation, his conduct outside it?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I do not see that appellant raised this argument in his brief. So it was not raised, and I view it as waived. I mean, so I don't think that that is a proper basis to conclude that there was an abuse of discretion. With regard to the court's question, it would seem to me, I mean, what happened here is the appellant was in contempt of court. He stopped unilaterally paying spousal maintenance in August 2020, which required my client then to expend funds to enforce the court's order. And then we have the series of what happened in this case with the stopping and starting and not answering discovery. And then it was 3 months into after he stopped paying maintenance unilaterally. And when the motion to enforce was pending, that he finally made the motion to terminate. So I think it all was within the court proceedings. And I think it's properly within the realm of the trial court and its discretion to award conduct-based fees under the facts of this case.
So the proceedings, you would argue then that, I mean, district court does reference those earlier proceedings that were started and stopped by him. You would argue, I guess, that it's inside the litigation generally when you extend the litigation period beyond the August.
Exactly, because he's stopping and starting, and you know, he had a motion that he had pending in 2019, and then in January 2020, he just abruptly didn't respond and where he wanted to terminate. And then, like I said, in August 2020, then he just stops paying and writes a letter to my client, says, you know, I'm not paying anymore. And then he waits till November to make the motion. So under these circumstances, given this whole realm of starting and stopping and in and out, I mean, it is within the proceedings, and therefore there is no abuse of discretion. And I ask that this court affirm the trial court in all respects.
Thank you. Mr. Navarro, do you have any rebuttal?
Just real briefly, Your Honor. I'll touch on the attorney's fees issue just real quickly, since it's sort of at the end there. Judge Smith, I think you touched on it a bit here. With respect to the attorney's fees, I think the question is, are they inside or outside of the litigation? And counsel argues that it's all sort of one litigation as a whole, and therefore the court didn't abuse the discretion of awarding attorney's fees. But if with that logic, the court would have awarded all of the respondent's attorney's fees, because the discovery and the starting and stopping occurred several months before that, if that's how we need to characterize it. But the court would have awarded all of his attorney's fees. But when the respondent moved the court in August, we had the hearing December 1st or 11th, I believe. And so there was a very short window where the parties submitted their motions, and we litigated that. Went to the hearing, and the court awarded attorney's fees based on conduct that occurred well before that particular time frame, which the court specifies. So I think the court abuses discretion by awarding those attorney's fees, because it's something that did occur outside of that litigation. With respect to counsel's statement that my client dissipated some assets by gifting some money, I believe it was Judge Riley, you had mentioned, well, it was for schooling, and it was. I think out of the $52,000 he quote unquote gifted, $5,000 was actually a gift to one of his sons. Counsel argues that, well, he's doing that in anticipation of this modification, but I mean, the children are going to school at that time, and therefore that's why he had to spend some of his money or gift, I guess, some of the money to help them out with tuition. Tuition couldn't, you know, wasn't 10 years ago. It was at that time. So with respect to the house and some of these,
I mean, on that point, I mean, I get education is expensive, having, you know, sent three children to college. But at the end of the day, what authority is it that says I can give that money for my children's education when I'm not paying the ordered maintenance to Ms. Hunt's client?
I'm glad you asked that, because at that time he was paying his maintenance obligation. He had no idea he was going to be resourced from IBM. Would he have liked to? I think maybe he relayed to respond to, hey, someday I want to retire. Of course, we all do. But he didn't know at that time that he's going to be resourced at IBM when he did. All right. So he thought he'd help his children out. With respect to the assets that were allegedly dissipated, Your Honors, counsel talks about the earning capacity or earning ability of this house, for example, and some of these other assets. Well, here again, when Judge Hayne asked me, well, what about this asset, this house? What's the earning capacity? Well, any asset can earn income. A vehicle can earn income. Are we to believe that the court's going to order us to be an Uber driver or rent that vehicle out or rent the house out? With the court's logic, I think here, if Mr. Pluchinski couldn't make his maintenance obligation, then he would have been forced to either rent the property out, live in it and take in a roommate, or sell the property. And that's not what the courts do, is force an individual to liquidate their non-marital assets to make a maintenance obligation. The fact of the matter is his income decreased by no efforts of his own. He was resourced, and that's where we sit. And we believe the court abused its discretion by modifying it to $2,000 and not terminating it. So that's all I have, Your Honors. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your arguments and your briefing, and we will have our decision out within the 90 days.